Maui is the home of one of the country's most honored poets, W.S. Merwin, former U.S. Poet Laureate and Pulitzer Prize winner. The occasion of his 90th birthday has brought another much-honored poet, Edward Hirsch, to Hawaii for a tribute event this weekend as part of the Merwin Conservancy's practice of bringing some of Merwin's kindred spirits to the island. Edward Hirsch is with us in our studio. And thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, my great pleasure.
It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Chris.
We were talking earlier about, I was just telling you an anecdote a few minutes ago about a friend of mine in the news media who basically said, I have no use for poetry, and kind of challenged me to make a case for poetry as part of our lives. How would you have responded to that particular challenge?
I would say that, first I'd say there's never been a culture without poetry in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. So that suggests that it's not just that there's some, you know, freaky avant-garde people who like it. It means that poetry carries some kind of information that you can't get from the news, actually. You get it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I would say it speaks to our affective lives, your inner life, mm-hmm. the overflow of feeling that you have, the record of what it was exactly like, but what it felt like mm-hmm. through language. It's the art of language, which is one of the highest human achievements. So I would say that, you know, if you not just in moments of great stress, but certainly when people suffer deaths, when their children are born, when they get married, people turn in ritual occasions to poetry. The mm-hmm. reason for that is because they need something to articulate the overflow of feeling that they have. Mm-hmm. And they turn to lyric poetry to tell that story.
And when you hear it, you know it when you hear it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same reason that people turn to song. Mm-hmm. There's something elevated in it in terms of the way we feel.
I often feel that a poem on the page is only part of the experience, that it would have been ideal to have heard Yeats read The Second Coming, or to hear you or Merwin or any poet read his work.
It's kind of a score.
That's a very good analogy.
It's kind of a score. Now, the interesting thing about reading poetry is that when you read a poem, not just when you hear Yeats read, but when you read a Yeats poem aloud, you are the vehicle of that poem. Mm-hmm. Your voice, your vocal cords, your body. That's not true in music, for example. But it's not true when you play a sonata mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. Mozart. But when you read a poem, you are taking it into your own body, and mm-hmm. your own breath gives it life. I will say, though, that there is something to be said for reading as well as reciting poems aloud, because reading enables you to pause, to see something that you didn't see before, to reread.
Yeah.
So that's the difference between, say, the Homeric epics, which are oral, and, say, reading Sappho. So when Sappho takes two words like bittersweet, and she takes bitter and she puts sweet together, mm-hmm. two different words, and she says eros, the bittersweet, love, the bittersweet. She identifies a feeling that we recognize now but no one had named before. And giving you time to read it on the page, you go, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. Actually, and the fact that it also says it in a very few words.
Well, that's poetry.
The bittersweet, four words with that continue to resonate every time you say them.
Epic poems are the sort of the tale of the tribe. Lyric poems are the stories of individuals. And the art of lyric poetry is the art of condensation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about poetry that's very interesting and moving, I think, is that the way in which the thing is said is inseparable from what is being said. That is, it carries its own meaning. Mm-hmm. The Russian poet Osip Mandelstam said, if a poem can be paraphrased, then the sheets haven't been rumpled. Poetry hasn't spent the night.
That's pretty good.
I like it too.
Well, you also can a poem be translated?
The answer is yes and no.
Yeah.
You can never get an exact equivalent for the poem, but translation is also crucial.
Yeah.
Because there are poems in other languages that just you don't get that sensibility, that feeling.
Yeah.
And speaking of W.S. Merwin, he's been one of the greatest translators of our time.
He
spent much of his life translating poetry.
Yeah. And you have to be a poet yourself to translate a poem, I would imagine.
Well, I think the trouble with translating poetry is that literal translations don't work. Mm-hmm. And the reason you need a poet to translate, you also need someone who knows the language. But the reason a poet does it is because you need something equivalent in your own language mm-hmm. to make it work. And it's absolutely crucial for Western civilization that we read the Greek poems, for example, even if we don't know Greek.
Yeah.
And so every culture has a literature, and so we need translation to make that literature available to us.
Well, as soon as I raised the idea that it would be difficult to translate a poem, I thought of, you know, where would we be without the translations of Homer, which yield itself to infinite number of translations.
Exactly, or Horace, or Catullus, or Sappho, or the great Russians. I mean, it's just crucial to the endeavor of building a civilization. I like something that Mandelstam said about a movement called Acmeism, which he called a nostalgia for world culture. And I have that nostalgia, and I think translation is crucial to it.
Yeah, yeah. Talking about W.S. Merwin as a longtime resident of Hawaii and as someone who's very much bonded with the life of Hawaii as a, you know, raising palm trees on his property, what kind of effect has his work, knowing him, had on you and your work?
I'd say the main thing is his moral example. Mm-hmm. The poetry was never a career for him. It was always a vocation. It was always a calling. And he always saw poetry not just as a series of literary games, but as part of something for the completeness of life, for the completion of life. And for me, the model, the resolute model of working everything out in poetry, of thinking through poetry, and moving from a kind of despair that he felt about the world in the 1960s to trying to do something about it. He came here in 77 and began to tend the land and learn how to tend the land. So the example, the moral rectitude of it, and the giving of his life to it, and not just to his own poetry, but both to the land and to the poetry of others for his translations, that's been a tremendous model for me.
Each of his messages on email says, on the last day of the world, I would plant a tree.
Yes, that's the messages from the Merwin Conservancy.
Yeah.
Merwin himself doesn't use email. But yes, exactly. I brought that poem Place, by the way, that has that line.
Uh-huh. Well, please read it, yeah.
This is called Place. On the last day of the world, I would want to plant a tree. What for? Not for the fruit. The tree that bears the fruit is not the one that was planted. I want the tree that stands in the earth for the first time, with the sun already going down, and the water touching its roots, and the earth full of the dead, and the clouds passing, one by one, over its leaves.
That's lovely, and as you were reading it, I thought of how so many people are likely to say, and I know you've heard this a million times when you talk about poetry, I don't know much about it. And as I heard that, I thought, I don't have to know anything.
Exactly. You might not know a lot about poetry, but you can just start where you are. And that's what I would say to what's there to know. Exactly.
Yeah.
You start wherever you are. Poetry is an experience. And I wouldn't concentrate too much on overinterpreting it. The more you're interested in poetry, the more you'll want to learn about it.
Yeah.
But I think you just start where it is. And a poem like that, which has its mysteries, but also its clarities, I think you can get it. You hear something right on the first time you hear it.
You get the clarities the first time around.
Absolutely.
And then as you reread, the mysteries come home to you.
They continue to deepen. Exactly.
Which is also, that moves us toward a definition of poetry, doesn't it? You know,
I think so. You have some kind of immediate experience. Emily Dickinson said when she read a book, she felt as if the top of her head were coming off. You have some kind of immediate experience.
Uh-huh.
And then the more you look at it, the more you see.
That's a really good. That's a really good way to look at it. And are you encouraged that people coming up, you know, young people today are responding to poetry, that they're going to be keeping it alive, creating new works, taking new directions?
It's a kind of a relief. Since there's never been a culture without poetry, I don't want us to be the ones who drop the ball.
If anybody could, it would be ours.
Yes, exactly. So we need to keep something alive. But you know, I think there will always be, you know, it can't just all be buying things all the time. It just can't be consumer culture.
Yeah.
It just can't be 24-hour news channels all the time. We need space for our interior lives. And poetry gives us that space the way religion does. But I'd say the difference between religion and poetry is that poetry is a kind of unauthorized testimony. It's the testimony of an individual without the creed of a church.
Uh-huh.
But it's someone saying, this is what it felt like to live here. This is what it was like for me.
That really puts it so well, Ed. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Edward Hirsch will take part in a tribute to W.S. Merwin this Friday at 7 p.m. at the McCoy Studio Theater at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center.